Great. Thanks, everyone, for joining us this morning. Very happy to be joined by World Wrestling Entertainment's CFO and Chief Strategy Officer, George Barrios. He was just named number three top CFO in media by Institutional Investor this week. So we're very happy to have you, George.
Thank you.
For those that are unfamiliar with the story, maybe if you could just take a few moments and kind of walk us through, what is WWE's kind of progression, major drivers of the business model, and how you think you're positioned in the media ecosystem?
Sure. Thank you. Yeah, so to provide a little bit of context, if you go back a few years ago, we had set out to reimagine the business as one that was much more digital, much more social, and much more direct-to-consumer. And as we sit here today, we're seeing the fruits of that labor. So over the last 12 months, we've set a record for revenue, over $700 million. Over the last 12 months, we've set a record for revenues from outside the U.S. of about $200 million. And when you look at the business at the highest level, the composition of that revenue is about two-thirds media, and then about the remaining third, tickets to the events, which obviously are a core of what we do. But the real importance there is that they create the media that we monetize. I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. And then consumer products, with the top three categories being our annual video game franchise, our action figure and toy franchise with Mattel, as well as apparel and 200 other licensees around the world. So if we step back and look at that, the two-thirds that's media, there's really three key platforms for us, and I'll talk a little bit about each of them. The first is our AVOD business, advertising video on demand. Includes our owned and operated websites, Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, and primarily from a monetization standpoint today, YouTube. So we set out about 5 or 6 years ago, I like to say before people thought social was cool, to own that platform. And as we sit here today, YouTube ranks WWE as the number one sports property on all of YouTube in the world. So more than FIFA, more than the NFL, more than the NBA. And they measure that by both viewership, so the number of views that we do on the platform, as well as the number of subscribers to the WWE Network within YouTube, the WWE YouTube Network. So today, about 12 billion or so video views over the last 12 months, so about a run rate of 1 billion video views. As I mentioned, we're the number one sports property on YouTube. In given months, we're the number one property overall in the world. So we've set out to own it. We do. From an engagement standpoint, it's where we feel the next generation of fans, and it's also become an important monetization engine for us. So that's digital video. Now, if you look at the more quote-unquote traditional social sites, whether it's Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, we're over 750 million user accounts across all those platforms and the multiple pages on each platform. Also makes us one of the top three sports brands across all the social properties. And in fact, John Cena, who is WWE's biggest superstar, is the number one North American athlete followed on Facebook. He's approaching close to 50 million followers just on his site alone. So again, social, digital, AVOD, great way to engage our fans 24/7, bring in new fans, younger fans into the property, and also becoming a significant monetization model for us. That's number one. The second one, and really what dates back for 30 years now, is the providing of live content. We provide 5 hours a week of live content, so 260 hours of live content, which we license to pay TV partners around the world. So in the United States, it would be to NBCUniversal or USA. In the U.K., it'd be Sky B. In India, Taj TV. In Latin America, to Fox. In the Middle East, to OSN. So all over the world, we license that 260 hours. Obviously, there's immense value to live content within the bundle, so we think that's the right place for that content today. What's really important for us on that platform is towards the end of 2013 through 2014, we renewed our seven largest agreements: the U.K., India, the U.S. being the largest, Latin America, Middle East. And those seven deals, on their last contracts, were generating about $130 million. And we guided and said through 2018, after the renewal and the escalators, those seven deals would be at $235 million. So about $105 million of contractual revenue guaranteed over that four-year period. So it's in the first time in the company's history that it had such a large portion of its revenue base contractually guaranteed, subject only to counterparty risk. The third platform, so we've talked about AVOD, we've talked about licensing live into the bundle. The third is our direct-to-consumer network. So I mentioned that four or five years ago, we set out to be digital, social, direct-to-consumer. We launched our direct-to-consumer network about 2.5 years ago. It's now our second largest business, our second most profitable business, and our fastest growing business. And the content that sits there is our most premium content. So 1 to 2 premium live events a month. If you use the sports analog, it would be our playoffs. So those 5 hours we license into the pay TV ecosystem, it's our regular season. On the network lives our playoffs, our most premium content. We also have over 100,000-hour library from content that we've created over the years, as well as libraries that we've purchased, wrestling libraries that we've purchased. We're slowly moving the best of that library onto the direct-to-consumer network. So we're now up to 6,000 hours. You get the premium, you get the long-tail archive, and then we've created new content using our own IP. So we've done animated series, we've done reality series, we've done docu-series similar to an ESPN 3030 about WWE's history. Parks Associates now says that with our 1.46 million subscribers that we average in the third quarter, we're now the fifth largest SVOD service in the United States. So you have the three big aggregators, General Entertainment, Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, of course. And then you have MLB is number 4, WWE is number 5. Behind us is Crunchyroll, NBA, NFL, HBO, CBS, and the rest of them. So that's where we sit today. Number one property on YouTube. Number one property on social for sports, one of the largest purveyor of live content into the pay TV bundle around the world, and now one of the largest direct-to-consumer SVOD services. So we feel really good about where we are today. When we look into the future, and you asked about the growth drivers, we see growth across those three platforms, and we've talked about them, and being able to monetize with more subscription, more licensing fees in the future, and more advertising supported. So we think there's a lot of growth around all three. The last element I'll mention, and it goes to the longer term, is today, as I said, about 30% of our revenue comes from outside the U.S. But if you actually look at the consumption across all those platforms, there was about 4 billion hours consumed across all three platforms in 15. About 70 or 75% of the consumption happens outside the U.S. So we think there's a real long tail as economies mature. India, for example, is our third largest market in terms of revenue, but our second largest in terms of social media and digital. We think as economies mature, that the disparity between the monetization today and the consumption begins to shrink for all good reason. So that's where we are.
Excellent. That's a great overview. Thank you so much, George. I guess digging into the WWE network a little bit, I think one of the big areas of focus for investors is how can you continue to grow that base? Obviously, you know, you've scaled pretty massively already, the fifth largest, but how are you thinking about gross adds? How are you thinking about churn? And are there other things that you can do to kind of bolt on kind of excitement, whether it's adding, you know, live ticketing events to, you know, the subscription? How are you thinking about really kind of continuing to drive that subscriber base?
Yeah, so going a little bit deeper there, as I mentioned, we averaged 1.46 million subscribers in the third quarter. We're now the fifth largest coming from outside the U.S. So for us, one of the great things about becoming more digital and becoming more direct-to-consumer is the amount of data that we're able to collect. And you see it the most, frankly, on WWE Network. In fact, we went on a pretty good investment run of building up the capabilities around being able to harvest the data, understand it, and then use it to drive a lot of the things that you just said, which is how do you get more people into the service? Once they're in, how do you engage them more? Because if you engage them, you retain them. So yeah, for us, it's about getting much, every day we get a little bit more sophisticated around the messaging, the targeted messaging. So I like to joke that when we started, we had one cohort who received the same message all the time. Today, we've got about 20 viewership cohorts because people view different things on the network, our subscribers. We've got 5 different value cohorts from high value segments to lower value segments. We've got the more demographic cohorts of how are you watching? Is it on mobile? Is it on big screen? Where in the world are you watching? What's your payment method? So all of that, we've gone from one cohort to 300 or 400 when you intersect all those. And it's really about targeted messaging, both in the acquisition and in the case I just mentioned, is on the retention, on making sure I can engage each individual subscriber just a little bit more. If we're able to do that continuously, we think over time, not only do we are able to bring more people into the service, but we improve the retention. So that's one element. That's the things that we control. There's another element of time. One of the things that, you know, when you've been around long enough, you realize that even the best ideas in the world, it takes time to change people's behavior. Nobody goes from 0 to 100 immediately. I like to point out Netflix, because I think it was interesting. Right before they launched their SVOD service, or they were still a DVD business, they came out and said, look, we think this service over time can get to 60 to 90 million subscribers in the U.S. I don't think they've ever given a number for international, but they gave one for the U.S. And if you look at, they're now at quarter number 26 or 27 since they've launched, and they've hit 77% of the 60 million, of the low end of the range. So, and they've slowly progressed towards that number. So I think there's an element of time. So we'll keep working on the things we can control. How do we get more people in? How do we get people to engage once they're in more and more in the content, which we think improves retention, and actually we see that. But I think there's also the element of time. It just takes time to change the behavior, and we're only 2.5 years into it.
Excellent. Thank you. And can you remind us what your guidance is for 4Q and for 2017 in terms of sub trajectory there?
Yeah, when we started the year, we said that if we were able to grow average paying subs by about 20 to 25% for the full year, we would hit about 70 to 85 million in OIBDA in 2016. And the third quarter, we gave guidance for both subs and OIBDA for the fourth quarter. And when you look at it for the full year, it will come in right around 25% average daily paid increase year over year, and at the upper end of the 70 to 85, so we said 80 to 84 for the full year. We also talked about 2017. We expect to set, you know, new record in subscriber levels in 17. We expect to set a record again in revenue. And we've said we're targeting $100 million of OIBDA or EBITDA, which would be our record as well. So we're looking forward to 2017.
Excellent. So next, I kind of want to move to the pay TV ecosystem. You know, obviously, as a rights holder, you guys have a stake in how the ecosystem evolves. A lot of focus on cord cutting and sub trajectory in the ecosystem. You obviously have long-term contracts in place through 2019 in the U.S., but how are you thinking about kind of your position there and the ability to continue to drive, you know, affiliate fee growth through time? You know, is that something that worries you? And how are you kind of believe your position there?
Sure. So, and for us, when you ask the question, obviously there's different pay TV ecosystems around the world. So if we were having a discussion about the U.S., and I'll focus there because it's the largest, but it's a little bit different if you're talking about India or if you're talking about Latin America. In the U.S., certainly, you know, we see the same data that everyone else sees, both from a subscriber standpoint or household, as well as from a rating standpoint. It's one of the reasons, again, 5 or 6 years ago, we made the commitment that we did to both the digital and social platforms, as well as the direct-to-consumer, because we, you know, look, it's cliche, but we saw the multi-platform world coming, and we wanted to make sure that we owned our presence on all three of those. So at the end of the day, as the owner of the intellectual property, we control our own destiny. Right? So every piece of content, where in the future, there was only one place for a piece of content to go. It would have been into the pay TV ecosystem. In the today, and it'll get more so in the future, every piece of content that we own, we'll have a decision to make. Where does it best fit? AVOD supported, SVOD supported, licensed within a bundle, and I think that's going to change over time. But the key for us is own each platform, have a super strong presence so we can make that decision, control our own destiny. Specifically, our pay TV in the U.S., we see the same numbers everyone else sees. I think, you know, I think absolute performance is one thing. You know, we've talked about ratings being down for just about everyone. But relative performance is important as well. As I mentioned before, we create 260 hours of live content a year. When you add up the average viewership over those 260 hours in the U.S., there's about 1 billion hours consumed, right, of our pay TV content, about 1 billion hours. We average roughly 4 million viewers per hour over the 260. That's the map. If you do that for everyone else, you know, we rank pretty well. We're at the top of the list. Not number one, maybe not number two, but we're there in the top 5 to 10. So our view, what we can control is drive viewership and engagement relative to everyone else in the ecosystem. And we think we do a pretty good job of that. So we think we'll do as well as you can do in that ecosystem. And I think there's a bull and bear case for a rights holder. I think there's a bear case that says, boy, the ecosystem is so challenged, you know, the next time we do our renewal, which is in a few years, 3 years, that's so challenged that it's difficult to, for a rights holder to extract economics. That's a bear case. I think the bull case is, you know, as bundles get skinnier, it becomes more and more critical for networks to be in the skinniest bundle to maintain as much distribution and affiliate fees as possible. And someone who can drive as much viewership as we can, we'd like to think is really valuable to a network. Obviously, USA is one of the top, has been one of the either number one, two, or three for the last 10 years since they've had WWE programming. And when you look at the numbers, we drive a significant portion of that primetime viewership. So we'd like to think that we create a lot of value for our partners.
Great. And I guess just on that topic, just with NBC Universal, maybe just expand upon your relationship with them. Do you think that there's more that you can do? Maybe, you know, on the park side, obviously Universal has a big presence there. Just kind of how you see that relationship evolving through time.
Yes, you know, it's a great relationship. As I mentioned, we've been with NBCU. Raw was on USA, obviously, for a very long time, and SmackDown was on Sci-Fi. Now both of them are live on USA, so we're a third of their weekday prime schedule and about half the total weekday prime viewership, roughly. So, you know, it's a great partnership. They ran a campaign over the last couple of years, which we've absolutely loved, which is called The Hero in All of Us. It's, you know, it's about WWE superstars and their position, in essence, in people's lives. And that while, you know, it's a story in the ring, at the core of what kind of binds us to our fans is, you know, is whether you're a kid or, you know, an old kid or a young kid, you look up to those superstars. And so anyway, to me, that was a great manifestation of this kind of how they feel about us. And we certainly love working with them. As far as the theme park, you know, I get that question all the time. People are fascinated with theme parks. I'm more fascinated with video IP. But we're going to do our biggest event this year. WrestleMania will be at the Citrus Bowl in Orlando. And obviously, NBC Universal has a really strong presence there. So I'm sure we'll do something with them around that.
Excellent. So your success with YouTube, I think, is the envy of a lot of media companies. You know, what do you think? Obviously, it's fantastic IP that's gotten you there, but maybe you could dig into the economics a little bit to the extent that you're able to kind of share that. And then other, you know, digital platforms like Facebook, like Snapchat, you know, how has that progressed and do you see bigger opportunities there?
Yeah, I mean, we are able to engage at a, you know, pretty deep level across all the platforms. So when you, so if you put the video on YouTube aside for a second, I mentioned all the social media accounts. Over the last 12 months, we've done about 1 billion engagements across them. So that would be a sharing of a piece of content or post, a retweeting. So that's how we define engagements. And we've done over 1 billion. Again, it makes us one of the biggest brands in the world in terms of that metric. So we love what we're able to do that there. As far as monetization, though, today, as we sit here today, YouTube certainly has, and they've been doing it a lot longer, so they are much more sophisticated. There's a behavior there from the user community about engaging with video for longer periods of time, which allows you to monetize through the pre-roll or the banner ads, or just more time spent watching the actual video. So way ahead today. Obviously, all of us here hear what, you know, what Facebook says, what Snapchat says, what Instagram says, that it's quote-unquote all about video, and then they see themselves becoming primarily video platforms in the future. So our expectation is, as users become more accustomed to watching, you know, longer clips, as the ad model kind of develops, that those will be, you know, great platforms for us as well. But today, from a monetization standpoint, YouTube is by far the clear leader. And look, we don't give a number, but that YouTube revenue is in our digital media segment, and it's grown dramatically over the last few years. So I like to say, you know, 5 years ago, we made about zero, and today it's a material relationship for us. So if the number one way we monetize content is our direct-to-consumer network, the number two way is licensing to NBCU, three and four are licensing to B-Sky, B and Taj. YouTube is now at that number five position or so. So it's material.
Great, thank you. So turning to international a little bit more, you know, you've referenced India as obviously, you know, one of your biggest markets. Maybe kind of walk us through how that came to be, you know, why there's such a strong fan base there, and then maybe how you can further tap into other emerging market growth areas like China, obviously, which I think is one of your kind of newer and faster growing markets.
Yeah, so if you plotted WWE's entry into a market, and then looked at it over time, kind of the revenue and the engagement metrics, you'd see kind of the traditional S-curve of a product introduction where it's kind of flat at the beginning, hits an inflection point, flat, hits another inflection point. Sometimes it comes back down the S-curve a little bit, you got to push it back on, but that's the path it's followed. So one of the reasons we're as successful in India as we are is because we've been there a long time, right? So it's made its way up the S-curve. So I think we're about close to 20 years in India. India also happens to have a pretty rich wrestling culture. For example, kabaddi is an ancient Indian wrestling sport. So there's a rich wrestling culture that I think helped inculcate the brand. But it's just been us in the market working with our partners for 20 years, building up the brand, bringing Indian talent into the storylines, going to India, whether it's to do an event or just even PSAs and or publicity tours. There's some great stuff where you Google John Cena in India and you see it. It looks like there's 20,000 people around him at a mall somewhere. So we've worked hard to build up the brand. And our hope is, you know, as that economy, obviously everybody lumps India and China together, but there's stark differences. And from an economic standpoint, is the size of the media market because of the size of the middle class. So India has about 4 million households in the middle class, and I think China is probably close to 50 million. Our hope is over the next 10 years, India follows a similar path in terms of macroeconomic growth. If we continue to be successful there in terms of the brand, I think those two things align really well for us. It's already our third largest market in terms of monetization, so it's a big revenue producer for us today, but if those things happen that I just mentioned, I think there's a much larger opportunity. China, on the other hand, it's a little bit further behind on the S-curve. We've only been in China about 8 or 9 years. And interestingly, if you looked at how much revenue we're now making out of China and compared it to 8 or 9, you know, 10 years ago or so in India, we're about the same place. So they're 8 or 9 years in, respectively, generating about the same amount of revenue. The big deal for us recently in China is we signed our first exclusive deal for our 5 hours of weekly live content. And what's unique about it, it's with a digital partner. So instead of the traditional pay TV model for those 5 hours, China is the one market where we've licensed the 5 hours to a digital partner. And if you know the China media ecosystem, you know, it's gone from 12 or so national networks. There's some, there are 25 or 30 regional networks. But the digital players are really becoming kind of aggressive in bundling content, acquiring Western rights, as well as indigenous rights, but bundling content. So yeah, we signed our first exclusive deal. Around that, the way we were working previously is we were delivering those 5 hours in an edited version in Mandarin and probably airing 2 to 3 weeks after they aired in the U.S. So there's a real long gap. And obviously, when you're as social and digital as we are, that there's doesn't really work to have the core content 2 or 3 hours behind when you're talking digitally about what's going on. So we've worked with our partner PPTV to bring the content, those 5 hours, day and date, both in English, subtitled, and then a few hours later with a voiceover, so you can watch it however you want to watch it in China. But that was, to us, is a big deal. But it's early days. Literally, the partnership is just a few months old. But we're excited. We're putting a lot more people on the ground in China. You know, probably one of the things that I do regret is when we made that our big social and digital push. Obviously, we're a small company, so we've got to make trade-offs. We have to prioritize. We said, look, we're going to really focus on the global platforms because we can leverage them around the world. So that's why we own YouTube and Facebook and Twitter. We didn't do the same level of investment, not even close, in China. So that's one of the things that we want to correct. So we're putting a lot of people on the ground, especially on the social digital side, to build up our presence on the indigenous platform. So, you know, our goal, and it's a lofty one, a real lofty one, but we want to be as big on Youku Tudo and as big on WeChat or Weibo as we are today on YouTube and Facebook and Twitter. That's a real lofty goal, but we like to set lofty goals for ourselves. So that's what we're going to try to accomplish.
Excellent. We'll see if we have any questions from the crowd.
All right. I just have a question regarding localization. You have a one-size-fits-all product with WWE Network. How might you localize to grow the network?
Yeah, so yeah, localization, it's a great question actually for all the content across all the platforms. So today, those 5 hours of weekly content that we license into the pay TV ecosystems around the world, we translate into 25 or so languages. So it's the same video, but you get it translated into different languages. And in some countries, it's subtitles, some countries it's voiced over, sometimes the graphics are in language. So the specifics of it vary a little country to country, but we've been localizing that content for a while. But it's the same video. On the social and digital, we've started probably over the last 12 months or so putting more people on the ground in markets to do something similar. Not every piece of social or digital video needs to be localized with language. If it's an action clip, people can tell what's happening. You don't really need to add a lot of words to that. But some of it you do. So we've begun localizing there. And to the specific of the question about the network, today WWE Network, in essence, is a U.S. product. It's priced at $9.99 around the world, English only, although you can watch some of our live specials in Spanish as well. And we have started earlier this year, within 24 hours, putting up multiple language versions of those specials, our pay-per-views, or what we call, you could think of as our playoffs. So we're already kind of dipping our toe in the water of localization. But I think the real opportunity for us as we look forward is saying, does it make sense, for example, to have a completely Spanish language version of WWE Network? Does it make sense to have a Hindi version of WWE Network or a German version? So those are things we're looking at. And it'll be, in essence, it becomes a matter of my guess is if you're 5 years from now looking back, you'll say you'll have at least one of those, maybe multiple language versions. The question is when. For us, the level of investment that we want to make, as well as what we think the return horizon on it. But yeah, it's something we're taking a hard look at because we've localized our other content to at least some degree.
One of the things that surprised me as I took a look at your company is what the demographic base looks like. Maybe just spend a little bit of time talking about, what does the WWE fan look like? Females, I think a much bigger representation than I would have guessed. So just kind of walk through, what the viewership fan base looks like, and are there any kind of growth areas or opportunities that you think there could be in terms of broadening that?
Yeah, so if I were to answer that question completely, we'd have to go country by country, right? Because
sure.
The fan looks different depending on the demography of the particular country that you're talking about. But we'll focus on the U.S. We'll do 12 to 15 million weekly viewers across our programming in the U.S. every week, unique viewers, according to Nielsen. If you broke that down, it would be about 60% male, 40% female. And I think you're right, that number kind of tends to surprise people. And you take the 40% of that number, you're talking, 4, 5, 6 million female viewership a week, which is more than if you went to a quote-unquote female-centric network, that's more viewers than they're getting on their top program. So while we skew male just because of our scale, we still have a pretty large female viewership. And the same thing goes for age. If you looked across the age demographic, we're kind of pretty well represented and look a lot like the U.S. population, in essence, because we're one of those pieces of content that gets co-viewed. It gets, our fans watch it together. It's parents with their kids, dads with their sons, moms, girlfriends, boyfriends. I mean, that's the way WWE content gets viewed. It's a shared experience. Now, what you have seen, interestingly, and it gets back to the pay TV question, is you've seen more and more, you see this really heavily on the kid-centric networks. The amount of viewership that's been lost on some of those networks over the last few years is staggering. You see a change in our viewership too, and it goes back to that YouTube discussion and some of those other platforms. You know, we know that those platforms are much younger in terms of overall demographics. So you do see that shift, but otherwise, in essence, our fan base looks like the population. Again, skew a little male, skew more African American in the U.S., but otherwise, it kind of just looks like the population.
One of the biggest areas of focus throughout the conference and through TMT is M&A and consolidation. Maybe you could just spend a minute talking about how you view yourselves within that discussion. I know Vince was asked on the call about it. Maybe just remind us of the ownership structure of the company.
Sure.
And you know, how you view your position strategically as, you know, live sports, you know, rights owner.
Yep. So Vince, who's the founder, Vince McMahon, the founder of WWE, and the CEO, owns 49% of the total share count. We have a dual class structure, A and B shares, so that his shares are B shares that have 10-to-1 super voting rights. So that's the ownership structure. Yeah, in reference to your question, on the last call, just given all the, you know, what's happened with UFC, Formula One, the AT&T Time Warner announcement had just come out. One of the questions to Vince was, look, would you consider being part of a bigger organization? And I think he said, of course. You know, I mean, if we think the economics make sense, and if we think someone could help execute what we think is a pretty powerful strategy quicker or more effectively, yeah, I think his term was, we're open for business. So I think that says it.
Got it. Okay. And circling back on WWE Network, you know, I think your scale is obviously, you know, the envy of a lot of companies. You know, Starz has had great success kind of scaling to nearly a million subscribers on the Amazon platform. You know, are you guys on the Amazon platform? Is that something that you would consider, or are there other distribution, you know, outlets that you see as, you know, being able to drive greater penetration subscriber base?
Yeah, so for those of you who don't know, the Amazon platform, they've got a couple. So there's the Fire platform, Fire TV, the Kindle Fire, the Stick. So that looks a lot more like the Roku environment or the Apple TV environment. Yes, we're on those. Your reference to Starz and the subscribers is, you know, as everyone knows, and it gets back to the whole pay TV ecosystem, in addition to the facilities-based MVPDs being bundlers of content, the non-facilities-based or virtual MVPDs are now cropping up. So the first one, the Sony View, you've got Verizon, you've got Dish's Sling, Amazon is doing something similar, and there'll be more players. So the whole notion of new bundlers coming into the ecosystem, I think, will be interesting. We've talked to all of them. We have not put WWE Network in any of those platforms. Our thinking really revolves around three things. Data sharing, kind of the consumption data, what our fans would be watching on those platforms, sharing of the customer information, email as an example, as well as the economics. You know, what are the economics? So, if we can get comfortable on those three dimensions, we're happy to be in one of those platforms. And right now, as of today, we haven't gotten comfortable.
Question.
Morning. This may have been answered. I came a little bit late, so apologies if that's the case. But can we just talk a little bit about key man risk, both at the highest level in terms of if Vince decided one day he'd had enough, what was that? What would that do strategically to the company? And then also kind of on a more granular level, if your top five wrestlers decided that they were getting better offers from Hollywood or something and decided to up and leave, how would that affect your churn? How would that impact your numbers?
Yeah, so I'll touch on the first one. Obviously, being the founder and a very hands-on CEO, to say that there's not an impact if Vince were to decide to leave, I think would be unfair. However, I mentioned before, we're a small company. We've grown quite a bit over the last few years. So, you know, we sit at 800 to 900 employees, and there's a lot of infrastructure, process and rigor around the core elements of what makes WWE, WWE. So that means whether it's writing the content, we have a staff of professional writers, whether it's producing the content, we have close to 300 people that produce all this video that we create, whether it's developing the talent, right? We have a facility down in Orlando, Florida, where we have anywhere from 50 to 75 talent that you wouldn't see on traditional TV that we're training for the next generation. So there's a ton of process and rigor on the creative side. On the business side, we've really grown our, for example, data and tech chops over the last 4 or 5 years. So like any company would miss its CEO, the reality is probably the greatest thing Vince has done in addition to building a great brand, he's built a sustainable organization, one that can move forward, I think, really comfortably if he ever decided to step away. On the superstars, you know, we always say it's a kind of a virtuous circle. You know, we provide a platform, social and digital, you know, those billion engagements, the 12 billion video views, 5 hours on traditional TV every week. Now on the network for our most ardent fans, a place where they can consume as much video as they want of their favorite superstars. So we have these three platforms, and that creates a lot of value for each individual. But by the same token, it really is the whole platform. And in our view, no single individual is greater than the platform. We will always have stars. We'll always be able to create stars. It's hard work. And you can't diminish how hard it is to do it, but we've been doing it for a long time. So I always chuckle because I'll run into someone and they'll go, oh, yeah. Well, but you guys were more popular back in the 80s or the 90s or the 2000s. And I've figured out it depends how old the person is. You know, if they're about my age, they think they were really, our heyday was the 70s. And if they're a little bit younger, they think it was the 80s. And the reality is we have more people consuming more content today than ever before across all those platforms, and it's because we've been able to go from Hulk Hogan to Stone Cold Steve Austin to The Rock to John Cena, and we'll see who's next. But we cherish each and every one superstar, but the real power of the brand is the entire platform.
I guess sticking with that theme of kind of leveraging the brand and kind of main events, you know, what are the next main events that you're focused on, and how much do those play a role in kind of seasonality and ebbs and flows in the subscriber base? You know, obviously WrestleMania, you know, key marquee event for you guys. You know, do you see churn kind of outside of those main events, and you know, are you thinking about ways to kind of, you know, make sure that stays kind of stable throughout the year and is not, you know, you don't see big subscriber upticks kind of around those main events?
Yeah, so when you're producing 300 hours of live video a year, and so, you know, at least 5 hours every week, and then our special events when we do them once or twice a month, I think you started with the question is, you know, what are you focused on? You're focused on the next week's event, making it as great as you possibly can. Obviously, we've got a real big event coming up Sunday. It'll be available on WWE Network. So for those of you who haven't downloaded it yet, first month is free and then $9.99 after that. And one of the premier matches is bringing actually some of our historic talent. So Goldberg, who I was a big fan of, and Brock Lesnar at Survivor Series this Sunday. So that's probably the next real big event as far as WWE Network. Yeah, and you mentioned that there's definitely a cadence monthly even of around those events, seeing kind of the preponderance of the acquisition for that particular month tends to happen around the event. And then when you step back and look at the year, and you mentioned WrestleMania, look, that's our Super Bowl. It's the biggest event we do. It's usually at the end of March, early April. This year will be Sunday, April 2nd, as I mentioned before, in the Citrus Bowl. So that, at least since we've launched the network, that is the peak every year of the subscriber count. Then you see kind of a sequential decline, which is why we always tell people, just look at the year-over-year numbers, because you can get caught up in the sequential. But there, we definitely have seen, don't know if that'll remain for the next, you know, X number of years, but certainly as we're looking back over the first 2.5 years, that there's a peak at that point in the year. So we definitely do see that.
Great. And then the last question from me, just kind of, you know, thinking about SWOT analysis, what do you see as the greatest untapped opportunities for you guys, and, you know, what kind of keeps you up at night?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest long-term opportunity for us is continuing to drive those three platforms, social and digital, pay TV, whoever's doing the bundling, could be traditional, it could be virtual, as well as direct to consumer. We think there's a lot of runway on those three platforms, and we think video is going to become more and more and more important and valuable. So that to me, coupled with the fact that 30% of the revenue comes from outside the US, but 70% of the consumption and engagement comes from outside the US, that to me is a huge long-term opportunity for us, you know, multi-year opportunity for us. And, you know, the thing that keeps me up at night is when you're creating entertainment, you have unlimited amount of competition because you're competing with everything that takes up someone's time, whether it's a video game, a toy, another piece of video. So people always think, you know, they'll ask, oh, is UFC a competition to you? Well, yes, because it's a form of entertainment, but it's no different a competitor than Grand Theft Auto or Dancing with the Stars or the NFL or a baseball game, anything that can take your attention, or PewDiePie on YouTube, anything that can take your attention away from us is competition. And so that you got to get up real early every single day and work your butt off to engage and entertain people and stay relevant around the world 24/7. We've been able to do it for 30 years and counting, but you know, we all get up every day saying that's what we got to do today. You got to put smiles on people's faces. If we do that, we'll figure out a way how to make money on that.
Excellent. Thanks so much, George.
Yeah, thanks for having us.